Hello and welcome to the podcast of McGill University's East 306 class. Today is March 7th, 2011. East 306 is an experimental radio course pioneered by Adrian Hurley and Natalia Yevdokimova. The students are required to conduct weekly interviews with various authors, activists, and professors. Topics will include modern Japanese literature, social justice in contemporary Japan, critical ethnic studies, Pan-Asian activism, and the like. The result of the students' work will be posted on the blog located at east306.wordpress.com. The majority of the content will also air on Montreal CKUT 90.3 FM. So if you're in the area, please tune in. If you're on the web, check out CKUT at ckut.ca to access their archives. Today, Samantha Chrysanthis interviews Dan Tsang about his show on KUCI called Subversity and his ideas on data liberation. Do stay tuned.
My name is Samantha Chrysanthis, and today I'll be interviewing Dan Tsang, a data librarian and Asian American Studies, Political Science, and Economics bibliographer, who's the host of Subversity, a progressive public affairs program broadcast on KUCI, UC Irvine's public affairs radio station. Subversity with Dan Tsang has been on the air for a total of 15 years, and it is very important because it broadcasts quite simply what mainstream media won't. I want to say thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today. I'm really excited about the work you do both to demand our attention and not let your listeners forget so much the important figures and media texts that have emerged since Subversity began. So why radio broadcasting? Why Subversity? How did this all begin?
Well, actually, I had a student who was working for me in 1993 who was already a talk show host on KUCI. And he had actually a three-hour program called Freedom of Voice, where he would tackle contemporary issues. He was an undergrad. And he probably had a better memory than I do. And he could remember facts and just really talk really well and discuss political issues on the air. And for 3 hours, actually. And so what happened was there was some big case going on at the time in 93, and I ended up getting involved in, there was a protest in a city in Orange County here. Orange County is you may have heard of it. It's
yes.
Actually where Disneyland is. but so it's actually, at that time, it was quite a conservative town.
Yeah.
And it was embroiled in some police harassment issue, and some of the students had been protesting at a city council locally, and I heard about it, and I went to the city council meeting and gave a talk. They're protesting, they're taking pictures of young high school students, actually, secondary school students, and the local paper covered it, and at about the same time, a different set of high school students had been stopped by the police, and their parents get the local paper, so they read it and read about this protest, and then they ended up calling me at work at the library about this protest because they had also been stopped in a different city. And so when I told my student about it, he said, oh, let's have them on his show. So I had two of the girls on the show. He interviewed them, and then my student said, oh, you could have your own show. So that's what I did. I applied for a show and got it.
Okay. So I'm going to continue actually by probing you a bit on the racial profiling you'll see in Southern California. Could you maybe expand on the cases you were talking about just now?
Oh, at the time, they were picking out and harassing kids who were wearing baggy pants. And the police thought that these were signs of gang culture, and they happened to pick on these Southeast Asian kids. There were two Vietnamese kids and one Hmong kid from Laos, and they liked wearing baggy pants. It was a fashion statement, actually. And two of them actually did really well in school, were honor students, and they weren't actually involved in a gang, but they were just waiting for a car to pick them up, for a friend to pick them up or something, or family or whatever. And the police zoomed in. They have gang units in these police cars, and they just rounded them up and detained them and took their picture. At that time, the camera of choice was a Polaroid. This is before digital cameras. Yeah. And so now it's probably ubiquitous. but I can get into what happens now. But at the time, they took their pictures, and I thought it was wrong for them to take pictures of people who are not, you know, being charged with any crime. And then it turned out it was very prevalent in the county and outside the county in L.A. We're kind of south of Los Angeles. And so at that time, there weren't that many Asians. Now Asians are kind of much more in Orange County, and especially at my school. I work at University of California, Irvine, and the majority of the students are Asian, actually. It's the largest percentage of any school in the U.S.
Yeah, I remember Hawaii. I remember reading that it's something like 60% of the students at UC Irvine are Asian descent.
It goes up and down. So, yeah, it's like being in Hong Kong when I go outside. But anyway, so these students were singled out because they were, maybe they looked out of place there or something, I don't know. So the cops, or maybe they have a quota to, you know, take pictures, and I don't turn in numbers. I don't know. But anyway, they stopped them. And so I was able to get some civil liberties group, American Civil Liberties Union, to get involved and help them. And their parents agreed that they could file a lawsuit. So eventually, two or three of the kids did join in a lawsuit, and then eventually it widened to a class action lawsuit. And so they were able to basically be successful. The city of Garden Grove reached a settlement with the ACLU, and I think there were five kids at the time and who actually filed, and they each got $5,000, I think.
Okay.
So the policy was kind of, maybe they stopped taking pictures, but they didn't really, I didn't see too much change until, I think more recently, they don't need to take pictures on the street. Because their police in the secondary school is based in the school is now in security, and so they have access to the yearbook, to the student information, I'm sure, and so they really, they could use the yearbook pictures, and they know who every kid is anyway. because they're based in the school, so I think it's been diverted. They don't need to take Polaroid pictures before. Yeah, sometimes they used to not even. Sometimes they would detain kids, and then another car would come with a Polaroid and take it. But now, you know, now I think police cars even have video in their car. So I think it's kind of a moot point in that sense. The technology has advanced too fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the issue still remains. So in terms of, you know, I mean, I can take pictures of the cops in the street, but if they're taking it, it's a different thing, you know, because you don't know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting how, though the actual very conspicuous practice of taking photographs of youth has ended and maybe might not be an issue that would garner as much attention because of how obvious it is, but it's still going on. So, because my next question for you was going to be if you see any changes to police practice since the Garden Grove incident.
One thing we complained about was the word, the way they described in the field interview process. They put, you know, when you stop somebody in the street, the police are supposed to record the interaction on field interview cards and or forms. I'm not sure how they do it today, but they. In those days, they had a paper, or they recorded even the ethnicity of the people they detained, and they would put O for Oriental which is a pretty archaic terminology.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so we protested that. So I actually don't know. I don't know what they do today, because this is like almost 20 years ago. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was, you know, almost 20 years ago. So I hope they don't use that terminology still. But they do claim that in a public street they don't stop because of race or color of the skin. And we did get some good publicity right before the settlement on CBS Evening News. There's a program called Eye on America, and actually Connie Chung happened to be hosting that program that evening. And so the couple of the kids were featured in the article. And so so that got national publicity about this kind of incident. But subsequently, I think the gang database actually went nationwide, I think. Yeah, it used to be called Cow Gang, and then it was changed, the name changed, and now, of course, with this whole terrorism focus, you can't even, you know, it's not, they take pictures of you, but if you're taking pictures of some other thing that they don't like, you could be hauled in for questioning. We had some Muslim students at my school. They had been seeing, they had invited this Labour MP, a radical Labour MP from UK, to speak, Galloway,
yeah.
George Galloway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and after he spoke, they drove him to the Orange County Airport, which the big thing about this Orange County Airport is there's a picture of, there's a statue of John Wayne with his guns around his belt. But the students wanted to take a farewell picture of George Galloway, and so they took a picture of him at the airport. So a few days later, some police showed up at their homes and asked them why they were taking pictures at the airport. So I don't know who was under surveillance. Was it Galloway? Was it the students? Or were they trying to protect the airport from terrorists? So I have no idea. So that was kind of a spooky thing.
Yeah,
but you can't even take a tourist picture.
Yeah, because it's at the airport. I mean, you'd imagine that they'd be accustomed to having people taking photographs, but
yeah.
I guess not.
It's just, it's just they're getting super crazy about anything they think, especially of a person of color or somebody that looks different from the mainstream, even though the county has, the color makeup of the county has actually shifted.
Yeah.
There's actually more Latinos in schools now than in primary schools and secondary schools than anywhere else. Than the past. I mean, there's a majority enrolled in education at this point, you know, at the primary school level, you know.
Yeah, we were just actually mentioning the concept where we, the citizens, seems like we're under constant surveillance, where it's progressed to a point where we're not even aware of it anymore, and it's not as obvious as I'd mentioned earlier. But doing that back to the police and doing that back to figures of authority is seen as such a threat. I was wondering what you see our role, I guess, as members of the public, and what our role would be in raising awareness and what we can do to police misconduct.
I think that we have a right actually to take pictures back of them. Mm-hmm. And there's some efforts to educate the public. There's actually a video put out by a police watch group in Berkeley, or in Oakland, in Northern California, where they've sent out a video about how you can document police abuse, and they actually had suggested bringing a video camera and photographing what they're doing. And so the night that OJ was actually tracked by the police and arrested, I think, OJ was driving his pickup, or whatever, not pickup, SUV down the freeways in Orange County. That same night, I was actually watching that, going to a friend's house who was active in the group we had started over police abuse. This is back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched it on TV, and then I left the house, and I saw the police pull over this pickup with 13 kids on it, something like that. And obviously that's a violation of traffic rules, right? You can't have 13 kids in a vehicle. But they were actually, so I videotaped it. I actually stood across the street and videotaped it, and they saw me I was far away that I wasn't interfering with what the cops were doing. So when you do that, when you're observing police activities, it's important to not interfere with what they're doing. So I photographed these kids being stopped, and they would empty their, you know, their sandwich bags, their purses or whatever, handbags, whatever. They were boys and girls. And then make the boys roll up their sleeves to see the tattoos on their, on their sleeves, on their arm and stuff. And so it was, this was all at night, like 9 o'clock or something. And so I actually documented this whole thing. And so you could actually, if you stand far away and if you don't harass the police, if you just do it in a safe manner for yourself, also don't get run over by cars. It was a road, actually, and I was just far away from the other, on the other side. But on campus one time, I saw the police stopping some Asian person in a car right at the entrance to the parking lot. And so I reached into my bag. I was carrying some bag, and my camera happened to be in the bag, and I was reaching for it. And the cop asked me, "What are you reaching for?" And I said, "My camera." He said, "Okay." And then he went back to talking to the people in the car. So he knew he couldn't do anything. Although one time I did see some kids who were skateboarding on who had been accused of skateboarding on campus. They claimed they were just carrying the skateboard, but they were detained by two cops for skateboarding. And on campus, there are certain areas who can't skateboard, supposedly, because you might run over somebody, I guess. So they, I went up. I was walking down the steps of this right outside the library, and these two kids had been stopped by two cops, and I started taking pictures as I walked down the street, and the one cop said, "You cannot take pictures." I said, "I'm a journalist," and he said, "You're not." And so we argued a bit about that, and then the kid said, take the pictures, take the pictures." So I took them, and then eventually they gave me the information. I called the mother of the kid later to talk about it, and it turned out the police kept insisting I couldn't take pictures, so I filed a complaint with the police. You can always file a civilian complaint, and this was campus police. So I went over to the police department, and they were kind of rude. The duty officer said, "What are you complaining about?" And this was in the lobby with everybody listening, you know, there. And I said, I want to talk to a duty officer. The person at the counter wasn't actually the duty officer. So I was able to get a private meeting with him. And then I said, "This cop shouldn't have said I can't take pictures because it's in the public street and I wasn't bothering anybody. It was all in public." And so on Monday they called me back, and the policeman called me back and said, "How do you want to punish this officer?" I said, "I don't want to punish him. I just want him to know the rules." And he said, "Okay." And then a month later, the funny thing about the story is the month later, this cop who I had complained about called me up, and he said, "You're a librarian. You know how to find stuff. They sent me back to school to look up constitutional law. I can't find anything." So I actually had a manual from some group that looks at reporters' rights, and they actually have a chapter on what your rights are vis-a-vis the police and stuff, your rights to take pictures and all that. So I gave him the citation. We had it in the library, I think. And so
it's so pretty ironic.
So now he calls me a buddy, you know, when they're protests on campus and he's, you know, watching them, he comes up to me and pretends I'm his buddy. So, anyway.
It's funny how that's turned out, actually.
Yeah, so it was funny. And I didn't want him to lose his job over it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the problem is a lot of cops aren't trained, really, in how to handle protests. And right now we have a huge case going on, two cases, actually, students who were stopped, who were arrested for protesting outside the chancellor's office. And then the other students were protesting the ambassador from Israel. Michael Oren gave a talk here and chanted and disrupted his talk, although he actually finished his talk. But they were also arrested. And they actually impaneled a grand jury to investigate the Muslim students. And they also they ended up with just finding misdemeanor charges. But these are students and former students who are now facing jail time and fines. And the trials for both of these cases, it's Irvine 11 and Irvine 19. Some of them are not from Irvine, actually, but they are all, the trials are starting in a few weeks. So it's a pretty kind of damaging crackdown on civil liberties on campus because, you know, students protest all the time. So it seems kind of to have cast a chilling effect on campus if you're going to, you know, turn over the cases to the DA and have them be prosecuted for just normal stuff that, you know, Angela Davis was actually on campus, and she told this group that when she was a student in the 60s or 70s, they protested all the time. They took over buildings, renamed them at UC San Diego, and nobody ever got arrested. But Irvine seems to be setting an example to the authorities, I suppose, to try to say we can crack down and we can keep order, law and order. And ironically, the Muslim students, their charges were announced the same week the revolution was happening in, you know, Egypt and other places. So over there, you're allowed to protest and you even topple a government. But on the UC campus, you can't protest. You're arrested. It just seems like a lack of democracy somewhere.
That's really interesting. This actually leads me into a question that I have about the Orange Curtain, which I've read a little bit about. Obviously, we're it's a little difficult to get an exact feel for it here on the East Coast. But just to explain, I was wondering whether you'd be able to explain briefly to our listeners what the Orange Curtain is and also how you see subversity and the role of activism and awareness raising at UC Irvine as
Yeah, I mean, Orange Curtain is kind of it's a term they use because they feel that they're so isolated in the past, and there's this kind of right-wing conspiracy here where everything seems so right-wing in the past, and it's like, you know, people said, you know what, in the Cold War days, they used to describe Russia as what curtain? The Iron Curtain, I guess. And so it was just a play on words, but behind the reality, behind that description was a reality of just all white, basically all white county where conservatives really were in power, and there was no diversity. And that's most well portrayed, the best portrayal of that is on the TV series, The O.C., Yeah, which was how they depicted this county as a group of rich white kids, basically, who party all the time and stuff. And I didn't watch it, so I actually shouldn't say too much about it. But it's such a stereotypical image that, you know, the newspapers wrote about it. And so I wanted to counter that, the image, even before this TV show. And so I knew that there was stuff going on, there was activism going on, and that people... There were activists here all the time. There were peace activists. A lot of retirees retire in Orange County, and they were active in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. And, you know, so there's a long history of people who may have been active somewhere else, but they moved here, or they were active here. And so I've been also trying to excavate the past and look into 60s movements. And I once wrote about the activism in Irvine by the first class of students at UC Irvine. They had organized a SDS chapter, Students for Democratic Society chapter. Teaching fellow, had led it, and one of the undergrads who was in it also was involved. And they had protested the Vietnam War at a nearby naval base, El Toro. When that closed, I wrote an article for the OC Weekly, our alternative paper, about that. I got some declassified documents from the Office of Naval Intelligence. I'd actually written to the FBI for files on UCI, and they referred my one of the requests was referred to the Office of Naval Intelligence because they were the holders of the original documents. And so I've got all these files back, and it was great because they even had photographs they had to photocopy, and they kept track of every car that was parked by the protesters outside the base, or outside the train station, actually, because they knew that people were arriving by train to go to the protests. And when I wrote the article, I actually was able to use Google by that time and and locate the head of the SDS on campus and this graduate student, the undergrad or graduate student, I can't remember now. And this was like, you know, 20, 30 years later, and was able to interview them. And the head of the SDS then is still active in peace causes at this point. And the student ended up editing a music magazine, actually. So anyway, their speeches were quoted, and their names were there. So usually these files, they cross out the names, but because they made a public speech, I guess. But then there were other names of people that marched that they forgot to cross out, but I couldn't track those down. And then I've talked to other people who remember the case, and yeah, and then I run into people in LA sometimes who remember that they were at the rally when this happened. So I think it's important to not forget that a lot of stuff has happened before, and that we can find, I'm not sure about Canada, but there must be public records acts in Canada too, that you can try to find out what the state has done in the past and get the documents. And, you know, there should be WikiLeaks everywhere to document this type of stuff, because it's easy to forget. The thing is that, I think all activists think that everything happened, anew, and it's not true, obviously. There's a whole history of, and we can learn from what happened in the past.
Yeah, that definitely is a very interesting point that you've brought out because of your role as a librarian. I have a couple of questions for you about what you're doing and how your radio broadcast relates to your profession as a librarian in library sciences at UC Irvine. I'm going to just start off with a basic question, which is that how would you find being a librarian would connect to activism for those of us who don't know?
Well, there's actually groups being formed now called Radical Librarians Group, or Radical Reference even, mm-hmm. and they would answer questions from radicals or about radicals, I guess, or on anything, I suppose. But I always thought that because a librarian would have access to resources and be able to find things that other people may not be able to, it really does help these causes to be able to have somebody be able to dig up stuff. And I actually think of Mao. I know people have many opinions about Chairman Mao, but Mao started off as a library assistant in the Peking Library. And actually, a lot of radicals probably found out about, the country's history of repression from reading about it if they didn't know about it from their parents or colleagues or whatever, classmates. But so I think there is people dismiss, they think everything's online now, but there's not everything is online yet, and nor would ever be, I suppose. Well, Google can't digitize everything, you really don't want Google to do everything. And so, but it does help that I have this job that, and I'm also the poli-sci librarian, so mm-hmm. I was able to have this synchronicity, I suppose, with my radio show. And so even the radio show is part of my university service. We're supposed to do university service as some kind of public service. So this is, since this is a public affairs, it qualifies, I think. And so, I think a lot of people have gone to library school because of knowing me. I have a lot of people that work for me and that ended up as librarians, and they think it's an interesting career, I guess. So I'm glad I inspired some of them to to take the leap. But I think libraries are becoming very corporate now, mm-hmm. and so it's quite a different task. And I was able to do a lot of this on my free time, So, it just depends. If they load you up with a lot of work, then you can't do it. You'll be exhausted by the time you go home. a lot of people, even with corporate jobs, they can do, activist work in there at night and whatever. And so there are ways to, be subversive, even in your work, I think. You can educate people. You can stimulate people. You don't have to. I think I'm essentially an optimist. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this type of work. Otherwise, you would give up, I think, and just move to the Bahamas or something, and rest and go swimming or something. But yeah. so, But I think the spoken word is still, I mean, the problem is nobody, I mean, not nobody, but very few people read a lot now. But actually, there's a lot of effort to put up radical texts and online for free even. And anarchists have done that a lot, actually. This whole anarchist movement of passing out pamphlets even, but also digitizing it and putting it online. So there's a whole kind of history of that going on to make resources more available and make it freely available.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting dynamic to be a librarian and have this amount of, I guess, institutional privilege and have access to all these documents. And it's great that you're able to use that access and share it with everyone in a democratic way, like through your radio broadcast.
Yeah, and also through, in the library world also, there's this move against, even though I know the library systems are becoming more corporate, but there is a counter tendency is to try to liberate information. I think in Canada, there's actually a data liberation movement to try to get government data free to users. So I understand in Canada, all sorts of data from government agencies are accessible for free in any public library even. Whereas in America, it's free, but it's not as much movement, I think. It started in Canada, actually. Mm-hmm. And I go to meetings with my Canadian colleagues who are data librarians, and they would wear T-shirts saying data liberation. And so in a way, they are the insurgents in the library world, too. But they are the leaders of this movement also to try to liberate information and make it accessible to people. And I was actually in Montreal at a data liberation a conference where people talked about that. So I think, you know, we can learn from Canadians also about how we can make the government much more responsive to the population. Life. I wonder, will it take me under?
Smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue behind the waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing. Fashion, designer clothes. Lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people hold a dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time. Watch the blimp read, the world is mine.
If I rule the world,
imagine that. Yo, it is easy. Paradise life relaxing. Black, Latino, and Anglo-Saxon. Armani exchange the range. Cast, lost tribe of Shabazz. Free at last. Brand new whips to crash. Then we laugh in the iller path. The villa houses for the crew. How we do? Trees for breakfast. Dime sexes have been stretches. So many years of depression make me vision the better living. Type of place to raise kids in. Open the eyes to the lies. History's told foul. But I'm as wise as the old owl. Plus the gold child. Seeing things like I was controlling. Click rolling. Tricking six digits on kicks and still holding. Trips to Paris, I civilized every savage. Give me one shot, I turn trite life to lavish. Political prisoner set free, stress free. No work release, purple M3s and jet skis. Feel the wind breeze in West Indies. I think Coretta Scott King, mayor of the cities, and reverse beans to Willie's. It sound foul, but every girl I meet to go downtown. I'd open every cell in Attica, send them to Africa. Story, how the thugs live in worry.
duck down in car seats, heat's mandatory. Running from Jake, getting chased, hunger for pigs. These are the breaks, many mistakes go down out of state. Wait, I had to let it marinate. We carry weight, trying to get laced. Flip the A stack to save. Millionaire plan to keep the gap with the cock camera. Making moves in Atlanta, back and forth scrambler. Cause you can have all the chips. Be poor or rich, still nobody want a nigga have a shit. If I ruled the world and everything in it, sky's the limit. I push the Q45 infinite. It wouldn't be no such thing as jealousies or B felony. Strictly living longevity to the destiny I thought I'd never see, but reality struck. Better find out before your time's out. What the fuck?
If I ruled the world, imagine if that. I'd free all myself. Black diamonds and pearls.
I guess to build off of this idea of data liberation, what role do you think that different types of technology that are coming out that may not necessarily be so institutionalized, like, or at least not so institutionalized with regards to the government, like Facebook, for example, or the ability to have your podcasts available on iTunes, how do you think that would affect access to information?
I mean, there are constraints, even on iTunes. I had a show that show called Vagina Chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Vagina Monologues, yes.
Monologues, sorry. confusing it. But when I put it on my iTunes shop, you know, whatever, I can upload my free podcast there and put it there. But when I did that, they censored the word vagina. So the only words that show up after these asterisks are monologues. So when people are looking for my show, you know, if you type in, I don't know what happens if I never typed in vagina. I wonder what happens. But since they deleted it from the heading of the playlist, so it just says dot 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 star 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 monologues. So you know, somebody there is thinking it's, we have to protect children or somebody from these subversive interviews. So it's kind of crazy. So I mean, there are barriers, even though it's making stuff more accessible. Even Facebook, you know, uses your information. If you click on something else, an application, it would drag up all your personal information and share it, even if you didn't want to share it. And so, so there are problems with that. And I think, I don't know if it's maybe it's a generational thing. We're more about privacy than maybe my students probably. Because they're more used to, you know, chatting and sharing their photos and their personal information on Facebook. So I don't know. I think, I mean, if you have a, you know, grassroots thing like WikiLeaks, I mean, that's the problem there is the state could crack down and stop your funding, you know, by stopping Amazon or PayPal or whatever from collecting money for you. Even donations, and so the state has a lot of power. But the people are more people, you know. So I think there's always ways to counter the state.
I'm actually going to go back to a point you were saying second or two ago about expectations of privacy and how a younger generation, I suppose, is less inclined to be guarded about their information and just. I was wondering what you thought about that, if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, in a way, I agree with them, because I think if everything is out in the open, then, you know, then you really, they can't use it against you, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, if everything is public, then we are used to public stuff, and so what's the big deal? But I actually went I filed a lawsuit against the CIA for spying on me. And the U.S. has this Privacy Act, U.S. Privacy Act, and it was enacted in the wake of abuses over spying on civilians and students protesting the Vietnam War. So after the war ended, Congress took a look at it and decided to enact the Privacy Act. And the key provision there is a provision that says the federal government, it applies only to the federal government, cannot collect or retain First Amendment related information relating to the First Amendment activities of U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So in theory, it cannot collect even of Canadians who live in the U.S. if they're permanent resident, in terms of their First Amendment activities, if they go to a protest, if they do whatever. So I had been indexing. Actually, I'm an indexer also. Mm-hmm. And I index COVID action information bulletin, which is now later became COVID Action Quarterly. And they were exposing CIA shenanigans in around the world. And so I used to index them. And so the CIA started keeping a file on me. I found out when I did a Privacy Act request. You can request stuff on Privacy Act for anything they have on you. And so I happened to not get it. You know, they said you can't get it because of national security. And so they made a big deal about, they wouldn't even tell me what the dates were of the documents they had on me. Because then they said I could figure out which country I was in and then figure out which country was, or what was happening. But I couldn't, actually. When they later gave me the dates, I still, or even the documents, I couldn't figure out what was going on or who did it. But they had shared my file with a foreign intelligence agency. So I thought, wow, I mean, if some Israeli, you know, spy service wants my file, they can ask the CIA for it. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. So I talked to some lawyers, and I actually filed my own lawsuit. I didn't have any lawyers, actually, that filed it for me. I just filed, anybody can file a lawsuit. Yeah. So I filed it, and then I freaked out because all these, you know, court dates came up and said they're going to dismiss it if you don't show up or whatever. So finally I got ACLU involved, and so eventually the case resolved itself after the Center for National Security in D.C. took on the case. They met with the CIA lawyer, and they settled the case. The CIA promised not to spy on me anymore, which is funny. But they refused to make it a class action to apply to everybody. They wouldn't say they wouldn't spy on everybody. And this was back in the, I think, 90s, actually, late 90s when they settled. And they said they were worried that I would go to a mosque, and they wanted to be able to track me at a mosque. I said, I'm not religious. But anyway, so now, of course, there's a whole controversy. There's a whole case in Orange County, actually, right now. The ACLU just took a case because the FBI went into the mosque in Orange County to spy. They sent an informant into the mosque to spy on other Muslims. So he filed a lawsuit against the CIA, the FBI, actually, just last week. So the ACLU took on his case, yeah. And he filed a lawsuit himself against the FBI, and then the ACLU took on a case against the FBI for spying on people in mosques. So it's kind of, so it shows that whenever the state does something, it's probably been thinking about doing it 10, 20 years earlier, or maybe done it, 100 years ago. My lawyers were surprised. They brought up mosques, Americans have a First Amendment right to go to a mosque or go to a church or whatever, but they wanted the right to do that in my case. And so that was kind of funny. The government would try to skirt around the rules. And since my case, of course, there was a new law in the U.S. called the the one after 9/11, the
Patriot Act.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, USA Patriot. Actually, USA PATN. You can spell it. Mm-hmm. That the words actually mean something, to protect something, and Patriot Act. And that actually says that they can basically do anything they want, basically, and they can even figure out if you have checked out a book, even. Although there are state laws that say the state cannot keep records of what you read, but they can go. I mean, the Patriot Act kind of trumps a lot of things. And in the USA, the Privacy Act actually has the provision I cited earlier as a qualification unless otherwise allowed by another law, you know. So the Privacy Act may, you know, some people may argue that that actually trumps the Privacy Act, but we haven't tested it yet, you know. Somebody should file another lawsuit and test it. But so I think the privacy was limited to, you know, to First Amendment activities. And the Supreme Court just upheld, you know, basically free speech, even hateful speech. This right-wing church who doesn't like gays has been demonstrating at funerals of even U.S. servicemen. And the Supreme Court said they have a right to do that. And so the First Amendment is a little bit, you know, it's every country is different. But here the First Amendment allows you to, you know, protest. The question is whether, you know, what you do is fits under the First Amendment. So it's a legalistic thing. But I think for activists, I think we should act like we have the right to speak out. The problem with these social media materials is that these technologies is that, like in China, they're saying now that they're going to keep track of everybody's phone messages or whatever, and to find out, you know, for congestion, traffic congestion, they're going to, I mean, if many people are gathering at a particular spot, they can divert and get more trains on or whatever, or buses or whatever. But of course, the fear among activists is that China is going to use this to track protests. If people are going to show up at a certain location, they can tell from the, you know, GPS that monitors your smartphone to tell how many people are gathering at this place. And then they can send more police there to outnumber you. And so I think there's good and bad. And I think, you know, there's a way to organize people. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the state may be one step ahead of you. So that's always something to want to watch out. I mean, I think it's still dangerous to text people and say, come to a revolution, or come to a protest, because somebody could use that against you later if the revolution fails, you know. So that's always the kind of catch-22. You don't know, you know, you want people to join with you, but then you never know if the people there are being watched.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how, just as we're being able to access each other more and more, the ways that that access is mediated is always vulnerable to surveillance. So we're kind of back at square one, as you were saying.
That's, although I think my attitude is that, you know, you just have to do everything so you don't get in trouble, mm-hmm. you know. But I know in some states, you know, some countries, that's impossible. You know, any kind of act could be deemed a threat to national security. I mean, in Western democracies, maybe there's more space for protesting. Although at UCI, it seems like it's more restricted at this point, especially for students. But I know, of course, you know, people with institutional jobs may have, you know, more privilege, of course, to speak out and stuff. Faculty have tenure in universities. Although, you know, that didn't stop some people from being fired and stuff. Yeah, so it's not a total safety.
Okay, what I maybe want to ask you about now is, given the unique fear, I guess, that students would have in jeopardizing their educations by participating in protests at universities and on the street, what advice would you give to student protesters in trying to get their message out there, but at the same time staying out of trouble?
Well, I mean, you could always do it anonymously. I mean, you could write leaflets, you could pass out leaflets, you could, I mean, if you don't want to join a demonstration, I mean, you could be a bystander and just, you know, I mean, they're different, you know, it depends on the campus, I think. If the campus isn't cracking down, then there's no problem with, you know, participating in a protest or sit-in. But if, you know, if short of that, I mean, there's other ways you can do anonymous support things. You can sign petitions and, you know, with fake names, I guess. I mean, But just be aware that everything you put online may show up somewhere, or even some email you write may be posted somewhere. So I'm always amazed that some petition I signed could show up, you know, 20 years later, saying that I'm supporting some, you know, crazy cause. And so, you know, it's just, it's, you know, and that's a fact, I guess, that it could happen. I mean, but if you, you know, if you believe in it, then you have to decide whether it's worth the risk. Everything is, has risks and benefits, every action you take, I think. And so you just have to consider that before you act. And I don't think you want to jeopardize your financial aid. I mean, if that, you know, if that's how, if you're depending on that to go to school, I mean, definitely, it's not worth it. Yeah. But unfortunately, you know, some people who were arrested, I think, did drop out of school, who were arrested in the recent protests on campus, you know, decided not to go on to a PhD, just ended with their master's or whatever. So it's, you know, there are consequences to what action you take, and it depends on whether you think you want to stay in academia, you stay, or you want to go out and do something else. So that's your decision. We can't, you know, nobody else can decide for you.
Now we're nearing the end of the interview, but while I've still got your attention and I can ask you whatever I'd like, what I'm gonna actually return to is, in keeping with this idea of archiving information and archiving events and people and places and how important librarians are to public memory and how subversity often unearths or resurrects different works or the lives of different people who you've encountered in your years as an activist. I just was wondering if there were any fallen activist or academic who's passed away recently who you think that we as university students in a social justice class should remember or get to know.
I once wrote about this. She's the spouse, the wife of a Japanese-American who was active in the Communist Party in the U.S., but she didn't get much attention, so it's, and I actually forgot both of the names, so I feel really bad. But I wrote an entry on her in some biography that it's like a historical biography of people, only people that have died, actually. And so, but she was very active in San Francisco labor movement. There was a strike in the 30s, and she actually ended up going into an internment camp, and she was not Japanese. But she was white actually. But she ended up, because she had a kid and the husband was in an internment camp during World War II. She ended up going in there with him, to because she wanted to raise a family together. And so so that was an interesting case. And the 30s is interesting because actually a lot of labor strife, a lot of because of that we got the the labor movement in the U.S. got the 5-hour. The work days were shortened to 5 days, and the 8-hour day maybe. And so, I mean, there were a lot of labor work conditions that improved after all these labor strife. And so there was some, digging up stuff is partly what I like to do, and partly, I mean, I got obsessed with state files on people, and so found out that you can easily get stuff if people are dead, actually, much more easily. The Privacy Act doesn't apply if you're dead. You don't have privacy in the U.S. I'm not sure about anywhere else. But so I used to, every few weeks, write to the FBI for files of dead activists, and you know, I even wrote for the file of Foucault, and he had come to the U.S., and all I got was his visa application. There was nothing about his activism or his gay stuff or whatever, S&M or whatever he did. Nothing on that. I was kind of disappointed. All I got was his application for a visa.
Okay.
So, I mean, if somebody is dead, then you have to write, you have to send an obituary along to show the FBI that, you know, that person really is dead, or an article in a newspaper, obituary in a newspaper, mm-hmm. because it's your words against, because otherwise people could say, I'm dead and get my file. So, yeah. So I think it's being a librarian is interesting because I was able to dig up stuff on, but, you know, so I think there should be an archive actually of, you know, the problem is all these are decentralized and a lot of, I mean, I don't even know whether I'm going to, you talk about public memory and or the memory, I mean, I can't remember things I did or, you know, people I write about or people I interviewed. So, but after I'm gone, I just hope, you know, there's a technology that's able to convert easily analog to digital and then preserve it digital forever. Because I have to deposit my tapes. You know, I mean, I know that's on iTunes and on, but who knows what happens to those. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because that's not really a repository. Mm-hmm. They don't have a archiving policy, I don't think. It's a business model, but doesn't include archiving. And so the problem is we need really, activists need to think about the future also and not just the past, about how to preserve these things so that we can teach and future generations and also, you know, they can learn from what has happened so they don't repeat the same mistakes, basically, you know.
You've actually introduced a completely new dynamic I'd never thought of before, which is how important it is to take control over the archiving of what you've produced or what you've deemed as important, because though it's readily available through all these giant corporations that archive files online, Google Books, for example, we have no control over whether that'll be around in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So that presents interesting food for thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I've written a lot of stuff over the years, articles and stuff, and they show up, all these databases that we pay thousands of dollars for in the library have articles I've written, even though I never gave permission for them. And the database producers, their point of view is that if the publisher gives the permission, then, you know, then they have the right. But technically in the U.S., the authors also have permission, unless they turned it over to the publication. And so I think it's important to retain the right, unless you don't believe in copyright. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of anarchists, they say anti-copy,
yes.
Anti-copy, copy left. So that's a new trend. Or there's a Creative Commons license,
yeah.
where you want everybody to use your content. So that's probably the better way to go. Because nobody's getting paid for content, really.
Yeah.
I mean, Huffington Post never pays anybody. They've used some of my protest stuff. And they used a picture I took at this protest that led to all these arrests outside this chancellor's office, and never paid, of course. And now they, you know, they just sold the AOL just bought them for millions of dollars. So somebody's making money off your stuff.
But,
yeah. So I mean, the corporate world, you know, deals with money, and activists want the word out. So, you know, and people thought the Huffington Post was a left publication, and it was, but she was savvy. Arianna Huffington was, mm-hmm. The head of it, was savvy enough to know that if you get people to come to your site, it's a new business model already. That's what businesses care about, number of hits.
Mm.
And so I hope your show brings more hits to your show. So somebody will buy you out. Yeah. No, I'm joking.
Can only hope, right?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I it's good to, you know, talk about creative control. You want control over your life also, even after you're gone. At least have some say, or leave some instructions. I think to see how it's presented, because I'm worried that if I give my stuff to an archive and they don't read Chinese, they'll toss all the articles about me in Chinese, or about what I did or what I wrote. And, you know, I mean, it's just, you need somebody who knows what's going on and to look at your files. And so it's better to, before you donate anything for activists, to be around, you know. I mean, to donate when you're alive. Don't leave it in your house and then somebody finds it later. and you have no say. So that, there's always to make plans. It's good to make plans, I think, mm-hmm. you know, about archiving, about deposit, about donating it to some nonprofit or some public institution.
Okay. Well, I think we're just about running out of time here. I want to thank you so much for speaking to us today about both getting the word out and making sure that the word is available for people to read and witness for many years to come. Thank you so much for participating, Dan.
Thank you so much, Sam. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay, I'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Samantha Chrysanthis and Dan Tsang. On this edition, you have listened to Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell and If I Ruled the World by Nas, both chosen by Samantha Chrysanthis. Please do tune in to our latest broadcast on March 14th.